Are you on dope?
Yes.
What kind?
Musical dope.
You get high?
Yes.
Off of what?
Music.
Are you on a trip or something?
Yes.
What kind of a trip?
Music.
How old are you?
I'm old in mind, but young in age.
This is Brianna Marie, and you're listening to Soul Discovery, a place run by passion and really dedicated to its music, artists, producers, and record labels, which makes it a unique place, but also a place where listeners come to really absorb themselves and can tap into their emotions and take themselves on a discovery of their own.
I think it's stronger than the strongest chain, deeper than the deepest sea. Baby, I love you because I'm weak for you. I'm weak for you, I'm a fool for you, and Lord knows I'm a freak for you. You got me hooked. Yeah, baby, you got me hooked. You know, a lot of men don't know how to appreciate that four-letter word, love. They believe in abusing their women, accusing their women. They don't know everything that they accuse and abuse about. If they keep on doing what they're doing, it's gonna happen sooner or later. That's the reason why I treat you so good. Because I want you looking good, you know? What love is? Love is something sweet. Love is something sweet like vibes. I'm gonna give you an idea. This is what I call love. This is what I call love. I believe I would beg, borrow, steal, rob, ride, and kill for you, honey. Crazy about you. I love you. Yes, I do. Every now and then, I had to remind myself of how much I love you. Sometimes I believe I love you more than I love myself. You know what I mean? The sweetest thing God ever put on this earth. That's why I love you.
You described your music once. I believe making records is like a picture. What do you mean by that?
I take music not just recording a record. I don't music as like recording is like painting a picture. Like you add various strokes of different things until you get it just like you think it should be. And because everybody's picture would be different, you know. You could paint the same thing, but every picture is going to be a little bit different. So the artist is seeing things through their eyes. And same thing with music. The artist is telling a story through their view of things. They're telling the story the way they see things. So that's the reason why making music, recording music, is just like a painting a picture. You paint the song to you what you think the song should be.
You, from day one, you haven't stopped painting. Have you run out of paint yet?
I hope I never run out of paint. But I'm enjoying this excursion in life, and it has truly been exciting. And I'm loving the new generation of people that embracing my music. And it's so beautiful. It's such a beautiful thing. Words can't even describe the joy that I get out of meeting the people that really enjoy my music. I enjoy all people, really. The ones that enjoy my music is a special treat for me.
Thank you.
Can it get any better? Lee Fields, Angle 3, Take Me Back. Lee, absolutely fantastic. The energy in that record. Do you remember recording that at the time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember just like it was yesterday.
Growing up, where were you born?
I was born in Wilson, actually Greene County, North Carolina.
Where did you learn your music? Did it come through the influences of your mother and father?
Yeah, both my mother and my father sang. Back in those days, for a man of color, it was hard to adequate income to support his family. So what daddy did, daddy and mama, rather, in their younger days when we were little kids, used to turn the house into a little speakeasy on the weekends. And they used to throw a lot of parties, you know, to make extra money, sell barbecue sandwiches and beer. And it was like... that's what they did in order to get enough money to buy their house that we grew up in Wilson. They bought a house because we was like, basically, my father was like renting various small little, back in those days, they call them shanties, you know, because they weren't the ideal place for a person to stay, but, you know, we didn't have no other choice. But he turned the house into a little speakeasy on the weekends and like on Friday and Saturdays, and have a lot of guests would come over. And so I heard a lot of music in those parties, because when they put us to bed, I would be hearing people like Jimmy Reed and Hank Ballard and Buddy Holly and Little Richard and Big Joe Turner. I can still hear those songs in my mind. Hank Williams. They would be playing these records, you know, for the little guests at their little parties. And when we were supposed to have been asleep, but, you know, every closed eye ain't sleep. So we'd be doing a lot of watching. And I was really influenced then by music. My desire wasn't at that point to become a singer, because I guess I was about 7 or 8 years old. And I see these people come in on to my father and mother parties that they would have on Friday and Saturdays, and the ladies be dancing, doing these wild dances, and the guys be dancing. And these same ladies I would see that Sunday in church, they'd be holding their hands up toward the sky, looking for something to fall down out of the sky. Curious about music at the time, because the music that was played in church was different than the music that these same ladies will be dancing to at my father and mother's party. Yeah. Now they're looking up at the sky. They're not doing these crazy dances. Now they're looking up at the sky. And then when the preacher come out and touch them, they fall down on the floor. So I couldn't understand all of this. That's what made me give great reverence to music. You know, because when I saw these ladies falling out in the church, you know, I was sort of wondering, what kind of power did this preacher have? You know, that's when I first started to gravitate toward music, through those experiences.
Yeah, so you were listening to all sorts. You were listening to the gospel. You were listening to the first sounds of R&B, and also...
The people responded. I was curious why the people were responding to music. When they come to the house, that kind of music, a certain way. And then when they get into the church house, they were responding to that kind of music a certain way. Mm. So I couldn't, you know, it had me to a point at one time where I thought the preacher had some sort of mystical powers, man, because he used to touch them, they'd fall out on the floor and stuff. And so that really got me curious about, well, what is this thing called music? Why people act like that?
in your life, there are times you go through change. Don't let it get you down. Keep your faith, keep your faith. You see the light shining bright. You can make it, you can make it. Stand up and face.
Mighty Mighty Love, 1978, that came out on a 7-inch on Angle 3 Records, and this came on the album as well, Let's Talk It Over. When did you actually move away from your hometown?
I was around 16. What took place was had decided to drop out of school, which I still regret to this day, and my mother tried to convince me not to, but I did anyway. Because of the love of music, I figured like I could make a living with that, and I was singing with a band out of Goldsboro, North Carolina. So I moved to Goldsboro when I was about 16 and a half, I guess. And I wouldn't advise any young person today to drop out of school at all, man. You know, but you know, I left. A person should try to acquire as much education as possible, but I learned it the hard way. But I would advise any young person, don't do that. Don't make the mistake that I made. But anyway, I moved to Goldsboro with the band and sang with them for about a year. And that's when I left and I came to New York.
While you were there, were you recording for any little labels while you were there at the time?
Are you talking about in Goldsboro, North Carolina?
Yes.
No, I hadn't cut anything at that particular point. I was like 16 and a half, and I worked with him about a year. And we were just doing cover songs. We were doing cover songs, whatever was current at the time. But we had a big following in North Carolina. And then I met this guy named Fred Williams, which told me if I ever decide to come to New York, and they, don't worry about nothing. He got everything, and he'll take care of everything. And they gave me a card. Decided to talk to my mother about it. I went back to Wilson and talked to my mother. Approaching 18, I was still 17. Mm-hmm. And I talked to my mother about it. I was going to New York. And she tried her best again to convince me not to go. Because she said she lived in New York for a while. And, you know, she was so afraid for me. Well, her child in New York, man, didn't know anybody. She really didn't want it to take place. So she tried to talk me out of it, but I was going anyway. So she gave me her last $20.
Wow.
To go to New York. And that's the only $20 I had when I come to New York, was $20 on a bus ticket. And a card with Fred's number on it. And I didn't know Fred that well. I saw him at the show maybe twice, and he gave me a card. But that's when I left home. I was around about 16 and a half.
So what was the first thing, what happened when you arrived in New York? Did you link up with him or not?
When I got to New York with the $20, Fred lived in Brooklyn, I'm at Port Authority. Now that's a story within itself. I didn't know how to ride the trains. I didn't know how to get to Brooklyn, so I was asking strangers. And one person told me to catch the train, and I didn't know nothing about the train, and then another person told me, suggested I should get a taxi. So I got a taxi. By the time I got to Fred, I didn't even know whether Fred was there at the place. So now, the taxi driver charged me like $18, and I got like $2 in my pocket left in New York City, hoping that this man is home as I walk up the doorstep and ringing his bell, hoping that he's home, because I didn't have but $2 in New York City, man. I was crazy. But anyway, he come to the door, man. When he saw me, he was so shocked to see me, man. His eyes, man, were like got big as 250 cents, man. He was what? The guy saw me, man. What you doing here? I said, man, you told me to come up here. And I found out he was getting married the next day. And he was, by chance, I caught him at the right time because he was just cleaning up his apartment to leave. He talked to his soon-to-be ex-landlady and asked her, he had a one-room apartment. And she said, yeah, you could take it, but somebody got to be responsible for paying it, the rent. So he talked to let me have the apartment because I promised that I would get a job. And I'm quite sure he probably agreed to pay if I couldn't pay. But the next day he had his wedding. And that's where I met a friend named Lonnie. I befriended him. There was a lot of places around New York where they used live music because I told him I'd sing. So he took me down to the club in Brooklyn called the 521, and they had a open mic night that night, registered to be on the open mic. And when I got the microphone, I saw singing and dancing, and people started throwing money on the floor. And they throw money on the floor, man, and so we took up about $100 that night. I had enough money to pay my rent. And I had about $27 in my pocket after the rent was paid. But $27 was a lot of money. Was a lot of money back then, man. I mean, we went out, we partied that night over 20, because back then in the 60s, man, you know, to give you an idea how much more valuable the dollar was, I mean, back then a pack of cigarettes was about 20 cents. And now a pack of cigarettes in New York costs you about $12. And that goes to show you how. And a gallon of gas was about 25 cents or something like that. Yeah. Now it's about $4. Back then, with $27 in my pocket, I could just... Man, we just had a good time that night. He took me a lot of places and went by a few more clubs. And next thing you know, I get a band asking me to be their singer. So the next thing you know, man, I got a gig around New York singing.
I knew why did we part?
Yeah, Bedford Records, Bewildered, Lee Fields, absolutely brilliant. That was written and arranged by Leonard Wilcup and Teddy Powell. How did you meet up with those guys, or was that just something that was handed to you?
Well, this particular Bewildered was done by Kip Anderson. This particular Bewildered was done by Kip Anderson. I went out to Charlotte. We drove from New York all the way down to Charlotte, North Carolina, to cut that record. Man, there was some good times, man. That was really bringing back a lot of good memories.
So you started with your own band. You started moving on. Things started happening around the club scene for you. When did the record side of it actually completely take off for you?
Well, after Bewildered, I began to get a pretty good following in the South and in New York, too. And so I'm doing, like, this is like late 60s, so I'm doing quite a few cabaret-type gigs, and I'm really making a living at this. And everything seemed to be pretty much all right. But it took a few years later for me to cut Let's Talk It Over. Before, this was like 73 when I cut Let's Talk It Over, and it was like the late 60s. Bewildered, but I was on a more or less... I had like such an act, you know, going similar to James, so I stayed busy. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really focusing a lot between those periods on cutting records, because I saw that I had a pretty good following around New York, and I had a good following in the South. So I'm working all the time, so I feel like I'm doing okay. Mm-hmm. And then early 70s, 1970, I cut one more record. I know you don't have that one. The one is called Fall for Survival.
I actually do.
oh, you got it?
Yeah.
That was Herb Abramson, the guy that was co-founder of Atlantic Records. He had his own studio. He had left Atlantic Records. And he used to tell me, man, about it. He was co-founder of Atlantic Records. I couldn't believe it. I didn't believe the guy, man. I really didn't. But he was. And he was telling me he used to be Ray Charles' manager and Wolf Brown. He was a manager and all of that kind of stuff. And I was saying to myself, when Herb was telling me that, man, I didn't believe him. At the time, they didn't have internet, so I would have, if they had internet or something like that, I would have went online and just found it to be true.
Totally different now. Yeah, that was on Festival Records, by the way.
Yeah, it was on Festival. Yeah, man. So I'm listening to this guy. Every time I go in the studio, he would bring periodically he would bring it up, because he was sort of bitter. I don't know what kind of conditions he left Atlantic Records under, but he was kind of bitter about that whole way it turned out. And he would bring it up every now and then. I would say to myself, "Oh, he go Herb telling me this stuff again." He know good and well he wasn't with no Atlantic Records. That's what I would say to myself, right? But I found out later that he was telling the truth. Oh, he was telling the truth.
So who were you working with in around that period then? Were you working with any other artists? Were you seeing any other artists?
Well, at that time, I had a brief stint with Kool & the Gang. Gene Redd put me in the group for some reason. Because Kool was a nice guy. I mean, he was still a nice guy. I ain't talked to him in a long time. But they was like jazz, kind of like jazz musicians.
Yeah.
But things didn't pan out for me, because I guess I wasn't as advanced as I should have been, because those guys were really focusing on what they really wanted to do. I was in search of trying to find out who I was, you know, so it was like two different worlds. We did some gigs together and stuff, and sort of drifted off. Next thing, you know, I'm doing my own thing again. Yeah. But Kool & Gang was like, they sort of put out hit after hit after hit. So I said to myself, oh man, I wish they would have stayed there. That didn't pan out. But then I cut this record with Herb Abramson. That was more my style. With Fall for Survival, I was more or less on the funk side. Kool & Gang, like, they was kind of jazz musicians, man. They really were accomplished musicians. And all of us was about the same age. Him and his brother Ronnie and George on the drums and Claytus. And I was hooked up there with Gene Redd for a minute. It didn't pan out. That didn't pan out. But it panned out for Kool, and they went on and made quite a few hits. And I'm still on the soul circuit doing what I do. So I let that go and just start focusing on what I need to do. But that little short stench with them made me realize that artists have to really be focused. I was like pretty much rambunctious from the South, naive, rough edges, man. I wasn't smoothed out. Cool them was smooth, but I wasn't smoothed out at that time. But it took me years later to realize that this business requires a lot of discipline. A lot of discipline. And when I look back in retrospect, I think to myself, how did I even manage just to stay here?
Going back to Kool & the Gang at the time, was that their golden period through Jungle Boogie? And
No, this was before Jungle Boogie.
Oh, was right? It? Oh,
this
right.
This was back with Kool & the Gang, the first record they had.
Right, okay, then, yeah. Cause
they had their first release.
Right, okay.
They had their first release.
Yeah, but I personally, my own opinion is, I think you've done the right thing moving away, because after the disco boom came in, Kool & the Gang kind of changed for me. That's my opinion. So
yeah.
You made the right decision. How did that affect you with the disco sound coming on? Because lots of labels were dropping real soul artists, weren't they? They just wanted that disco sound. Did that affect you?
What happened was, in that period, that little stench I had with Kool & the Gang made me realize I got to be focused. And I saw how smooth that they were and how focused they were and how serious they were taking it. And it made me get serious. And then I got married. I was married right around that period that I met Kool. And everything was changing. Soul music in the 70s and the mid-70s began to change. Began to change in late and early 80s. But getting back to that period where I was transcending from that point, I was still doing soul music. It was like early 70s, so I'm still working with my Southern audience and my New York following that I had. And I'm working regular, I'm working all the time. But now I'm married, so I'm really getting serious now, because, I'm no longer a teenager, and this is like 1970, and I'm no longer a teenager, man, and the years of watching Kool & the Gang all on TV, and it was a hurtful thing, but I was happy for him. I was never, like, jealous. I was happy. Yeah. I was truly happy to knowing I knew somebody that had made it through. And then I met people like Millie Jackson. We was on the same circuit, early 70s. And then she ended up getting a hit. Now I know a couple of people. And I'm still on, and I'm really getting serious now, man. So, and then it dawned upon me, then I landed the deal with London Records. Right after I got with London, the music has begun to change. They were looking for more or less self-contained acts. Artists that played and, it was a lot of group acts then. Self-contained groups, like Parliament, Funkadelic,
Brass Construction, etc.
Brass Construction and a bunch of groups. It was like self-contained groups. So, and I'm trying to figure out who I am, other than being labeled as a guy that's impersonating James Brown or something. That's when I, in my mind, and thought about all of the artists that I really was influenced by. People from that early childhood stage that I spoke of earlier, where Daddy was playing the music, started to take a little bit from everybody. Solomon Burke, a little bit from Bobby Bluebland, a little bit from the Beatles. A little bit from everybody to become me, because I think a person, as an artist, the artist that the person becomes is all of his or her influences. So that's when I started to kind of weave it all together. And that's how, through the years, I became me. In other words, people can hear my record now and don't say that sound like James, or that don't sound like Lee, because I found myself. But it took a lot of years to find me. I'm sure I did. I found myself because I knew what kind of records I want to make. Now, I could take a song, I make a song, and people would say, man, that sounds like you. You know, they don't compare it with, a spin off of Otis Redding. They could say, it sounds kind of like a little Otis Redding influence in there. I've heard Otis, I've heard James influences, I've heard even Brooke Benton, they say. I'm hearing everybody because everybody influenced me. I was influenced by everybody.
Yeah, but that's a sign of a true artist, listening to other artists and getting inspired and creating your own sound. That is what it's all about.
I do agree.
Soul Discovery, where the music just turns you inside out and creates masterpieces like that. Honey Dove, my special guest from the USA, Lee Fields. Lee, that's when the tide started to turn, in my opinion, for you, working with the likes of Jeff Silverman and my Leon Michaels. How did that happen?
Well, actually, I met Leon when I was the lead singer for a group called the Soul Providers, which Gabriel Roth was the leader of the band. The Soul Providers later changed their name to the Dap Kings. And Sharon was singing background on some of my records. And what happened was Leon was in Soul Providers. So we became good friends. I was on the blues circuit at the time. This was like late 90s. I was on the blues circuit at the time. Southern Soul Circuit. But I was cutting records. Philip Lehman and Gabriel Roth wanted me to cut tracks for them. That's how the whole thing started with the group called the Soul Providers. And one day, Leon decided to start his own company. And then the Soul Providers had changed their name to the Dap Kings, and Sharon was singing lead for them then. So I said, why not, you know? So Leon called me over, him and Jeff Silverman, and we started to cut a few tracks. First, it was Philip Lehman was in the picture. Mm. Philip Lehman and Leon Michaels and Nick was there. That's when we cut like Honey Dove. That led to one thing. Then Leon, as time passed, Leon started his own label. Philip Lehman decided to, you know, lost interest, I would assume, in the music industry. So now it's just Leon and Jeff. He left the studio with Leon and Jeff. So they called me over periodically to do a few songs. One song led to another one. Next thing you know, we came up with the album My World. But that's how all of that started. It started from Philip Lehman and Gabriel Roth with the Soul Providers, evolved into the Expressions, and that's where it's been ever since. Lee Fields and Expressions.
Yeah. Special guest is Lee Fields at Truth and Soul Records. So Truth and Soul was born. How does it fit into where you were trying to go? Was it the right solution to go with them at the time?
Absolutely. It was the right solution, because I'm able to, over Truth and Soul, I'm able to express myself as who I am, and opposed to mimicking another artist. So they allow me freedom to, you know, to be who I am. After all of these years, I feel as if it was well worth the long journey, because I feel like we're gonna make some songs, hopefully, that people will find very touching, very, you know, we want to touch the people's spirits, yeah. You know, and opposed to just entertaining from an entertainment point of, and opposed to just making melodies that people find to be likable. We want to touch people's spirits. In other words, we want to bring them a little joy, give them something that you, I can't describe it, but you know when you hear it, it make you feel good.
Oh, yes.
make you think about. So over Truth and Soul, I feel like the way we're doing things over there, just, yeah. It gives me that freedom to do that.
It's taking your strap line about being an artist that you paint, coming together with Truth and Soul, it's actually brought the colour into the painting. It's fulfilled the painting, hasn't it?
I couldn't have put it in better words.
So, yep,
that's exactly what I was trying to say.
What's it like to work in Truth? Is it spontaneous? It's not like the old regime. You've got a free hand. Is it everybody collaborating and working together and feeling it?
Everybody's collaborating. Everybody's working congruently together. And we like take all egos out before we walk in the door. Everybody's there for that purpose, man. You know, making it happen.
Yeah.
It's like it seemed like we were supposed to be together. Masterpiece, an absolute masterpiece. Love comes. Thank you.
It's absolutely brilliant. Tell me about the Expressions. Who are they? All the Bad members, and are they the same guys that do all the studio recordings as well?
Yes, it's all of them. It's the same guys. The same guys I use in the band. Nick, Vince. Now we'll rotate sometimes. Sometimes Nick doesn't be certain gigs he can't be on. But all of the recordings he's on. we're a substitute with Benny. But all the guys, every musician that you hear, you hear on the record, is the band that we travel with. Periodically, as I say, like, if one of the members can't be there for whatever reason, we have a substitute. It's the same part, you know, so we keep the same sound wherever we go.
We're moving forward. We've got your new album coming up in June. The first track has been released from it, Magnolia. Why that track?
Leon played a song by this guy, J.J. Kale. And I listened to the track and I fell in love with the song. Mm-hmm. And Leon said, you want to do it? I said, yeah, man, let's do this. So we did it. And, you know, we go strictly by feeling. You know, some artists believe that they have the knowledge of knowing what people are going to like and they're going to make what people like. We don't have that. The only thing we have is making what we like and hope that other people like it.
Yes, that's what it's about.
You know, so I listen to the song. I like the song. Leon liked the song. And Nick liked the song. So let's do this.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know the original, but it's got a lot of country feel in there with the sound. Is that deliberate?
Yeah, I'm happy that the steel guitar was put in there because it really makes, I really feel at home with that track, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like this is who I am because, you know, country and western music played a lot in my development as well. Mm. Because I did listen to Porter Wagoner and I did listen to Dolly Parton and still didn't. I might be riding along, man. I listen to a lot of soul music. I listen to Marvin Gaye. I listen to all of Motown. I listen to the Stax records. And I also listen to country and western too. I like a lot of country and western songs. I like all music.
Magnolia. Lee, that is absolutely blinder, and I can't wait to hear the rest of the album. Are you excited?
Very excited. Very, very much.
Yeah, and you're starting to do your tours. You're coming over to the UK shortly. You know you're sold out already.
Oh, wow. I'm so happy to hear that. That's very pleasing.
So you found home and you're happy with what's going on and you're pleased to be in this place at this present time because musically you really are leading the way.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thank you for taking your time out today interviewing me.
Lee Fields, you're a gentleman. Thank you very, very much. Once again, thank you to Lee Fields, absolute gentleman, and I'd like to say thank you to Gabby for setting that up with Chalky with all his help. Thank you, Chalky, and Dave Weldon and Michael Edwards. Thank you to you guys. Eddie Everson at the top of the hour, Taste of Soul, not to be missed. Don't forget next week's show, the All Winners Show, Easter Sunday. Send your dedication request right across. Thanks for being there. Good night.
You and I.